I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Jason Frank, the Robert J. Katz Chair of the Department of Government at Cornell University. We're discussing his 2021 book, The Democratic Sublime, on Aesthetics and Popular Assembly from Oxford University Press. Frank works on democratic theory, American political thought, politics and literature, and political aesthetics, and has published several books and articles on these topics. First of all, Jason Frank, thanks so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jason, I love the book. It's a great, I have a soft spot myself for aesthetics and politics, cutting my teeth with Nietzsche anyway. So I really enjoyed the way that you weave together analysis of the sublime with democratic theory and its applications to contemporary democratic theory as well. So, thank you for the book and congratulations on it. Let me start, as I always do, by just asking you what the motivation was for writing the book.
All right. I think the motivation, there is a political motivation and there are also kind of theoretical motivations, and maybe I'll say something about the political motivation first. I started thinking about this book roughly 10 years ago, after I'd finished my first book and was almost finished with the Publius and Political Imagination book. But at that time, like around 2011, there were this explosion of what we now think of as the square movements in response to the financial crisis of 2008. So, the Indignados in Spain, Occupy Wall Street in the United States, this just kind of resurgence of the politics of popular assembly. And of course, coming a year after also the revolutions of the Arab Spring. And it got me thinking about the centrality of popular assembly and protest, crowds, gatherings of the people out of doors to the entire history of democracy, and certainly to the history of modern democracy with the emergence of popular sovereignty. And democratic theorists have written a lot about this period and have had very interesting things to say about the emergence of a public sphere and, Habermas and the various ways in which that paradigm circulated around democratic theory, and especially kind of historically situated approaches to democratic theory. But there was very little work done by democratic theorists on the centrality of popular assembly to, let's just say, the modern democratic imaginary and the phenomena of crowds to the emergence of modern democracy. And it's something that I had thought about a little bit in my first book. I had a chapter on crowds in constituent moments, but I really wanted to bring a more sustained focus to this phenomenon, which is, it's a part of our own time. Crowds play such a central role in democratic histories across a wide variety of periods and geographies and so on. So that was really the kind of political kind of question that got me moving in the direction that I ultimately took in this book. And then, theoretically, I've always been interested in the relationship between politics and aesthetics. And I've written a little bit on some of these the kind of related issues in previous work, but I really wanted to draw together my interest in the history of popular sovereignty and the dilemmas and paradoxes that have accompanied that history, since the late 18th century, which is really the area that I have some specialization or expertise in. And the aesthetic dimensions of these political problems and dilemmas. So the kind of aesthetic turn that some people have identified in contemporary political theory, but really brought into conversation with debates in contemporary democratic theory and radical democratic theory around the politics of peoplehood, paradoxes of popular authorization, and what I come to focus on in this book is problems of popular manifestation and the democratic sublime. So those are the two kind of broad motivations for the overall project. But it started with just an interest in why democratic theory had not attended enough and in a more sustained way to what I see as a central phenomenon of modern democratic life, which is the politics of popular assembly.
Yeah, good. And the book examines the way that the populace appears, and appears particularly as sublime, or is portrayed as sublime. I mean, I thought just to sort of get us introduced to this idea of the democratic sublime, I was hoping you could sort of clarify what you mean by it. In part, I was surprised when I, read the title, Democratic Sublime, so what could that mean? In part, because I think we typically associate the sublime with, the dignity and the grandeur of the sublime with the ancien regime, with the sort of monarchical regime. So the development of the democracy in the wake of the destruction of the ancien regime, is often associated with, putting all that propaganda in the past, the royal habits and regalia and so forth, and moving towards a more rationalistic approach to politics, even in Thomas Paine, Jürgen Habermas. So maybe you could say a little bit about what you mean by the democratic sublime and what it is and when it starts to appear.
Sure. I think answering that question, a good place to start might be with the familiar story that you just outlined that would make the idea of the democratic sublime a surprise. So I am critical in this book of what I characterize as the thesis of democratic disenchantment. So you mentioned Paine, you mentioned Habermas, but it's a pretty familiar story, as you just said, Jeff, that in the 18th century, with the emergence of the democratic revolutions in the United States and France, and then following into the 19th century, the emergence of a ratio-critical public sphere of citizens, that politics is in important respects disenchanted. The royal authority that depended upon pomp, circumstance, ritualized forms of authorization, as popular sovereignty emerges as a hegemonic legitimating norm, you have a replacement with those enchanted forms of royal authority with a reasoned, deliberative, as I said, ratio-critical, iconoclastic, very important for Paine, politics that is anchored in interest, in people deliberating and deciding for themselves on the political course that they want to set democratically. And it's a deeply ingrained story for us. I mean, I think it's transmitted by political theorists and democratic theorists, but it's also just a kind of part of the popular imagination of modern democracy. And its relationship to the emergence of autonomy. We can identify different aspects or different contours of the story. I think the democratic disenchantment story is very misleading in important respects, because democracy and the emergence of popular sovereignty also requires entirely new investments of political imagination, new forms of collective fantasy, especially around the constituent subject of modern democracy, which is to say the people. So to put it in very simplified terms, the king The body of the king, if you think about, you know, the discourse of the king's two bodies that Kantorovich and so on has investigated so influentially. One thing about the discourse of royal sovereignty is that sovereignty emanates from the body of the king. The body of the king does not have to be imagined or fantasized about. It can be physically present. And one of the important shifts that comes about with that transition from royal to popular sovereignty and the replacement of the embodied king with an ambiguously embodied, if not fully disembodied people, is the people has to be imagined. Like there has to be a sense of who the people are, what its contours are, what its characteristics and qualities are, how it appears, how the people publicly appear, how they act. I argue in the book that this is a kind of central enchantment of modern democracy. It's an elicitation of popular imagination, focused and constantly invigorated and reinvigorated around this question of that constituent sovereign subject at the heart of any theory of modern democracy. So that's already to kind of run counter against a simple democratic disenchantment thesis. But aesthetically, this shift that I'm talking about also is a shift around the question of the sublime. And I thematize it in the book in terms of the immanentization of the sublime. So the sublime, rather than being an experience of transcendence and most obviously religious transcendence, comes to be embedded in the world of human, the secular world of human action and experience itself. So this is a broad reorientation in art. It's often associated with romanticism, but it's also a drag. I think you can identify what I'm calling this kind of immanentization of the sublime across the mid to late 18th to the well into the 19th century, across a number of canonical political theorists. So in the book, I look at Rousseau, and I kind of develop, I don't know if we'll talk about this, an emphasis on Rousseau's account of kind of reverential collective absorption as a version of a kind of sublime experience, although he's not exactly a theorist of the sublime in the same way that Burke is a theorist of sublime. And Burke is another example of this immanentization of the sublime. And Tocqueville, in his theory of the grandeur of the public realm, I try to argue is also an example of this. So just kind of three examples of kind of canonical political theorists that participate in this broader shift. I mean, I think it reaches something like its apotheosis in the middle of the 19th century of the United States with figures like Emerson and Walt Whitman, who I don't talk about in this book, but I've discussed in other books. So, okay, so the idea of the democratic sublime then is it's a particular instance of this broader problem of the kind of question of the immanentization of the sublime. So in the book, I track the way in which the forever invisible or unrepresentable people take on through popular assembly and kind of mass gatherings of collectives, notably sublime, awesome attributes, the kind of reverential of the reverence and awe in the face of collective power as instantiated through these forms of collective manifestation. So that's, I mean, you know, we can talk about some of the specifics of this if you want with the examples that I bring out in the book, but I guess I would just, I'll end this, you know, these remarks here. You know, one of the quotes that I returned to a few times in the book, I thought about using it as an epigraph, but I decided to use an epigraph from Tocqueville instead, is a paraphrase from Robespierre, when he says before the convention that the people must see themselves assembled in order to feel their power. So the sense of kind of the people experiencing oneself as a part of an empowered democratic collective, that experience has importantly aesthetic contours to it that I really try to draw out and reconstruct in the book across a very, kind of a diverse archive, you might say. But I'm very interested in how this idea of the democratic sublime can be seen as a response to a very basic question engendered by democratic revolutions, which is how can a newly empowered people at once manifest its collective power and also at the same time remain forever ineffable or beyond any single given instantiation or form. This idea of the sublime is very closely linked to the idea of the ineffable, right? There's something, the presentation of that which cannot be fully represented. That is really a kind of core conceptual part of the theory of the democratic sublime that I try to elaborate, you know, in a more kind of fine-grained and detailed way across the different chapters of the book.
Yeah, that's great. It's really helpful. In part, this, I think that anticipates something of my next question, which the expression that you really take up on the democratic sublime has to do with popular assembly. Because one of the questions I had was, well, does the democratic sublime manifest itself in institutions of representative governments, representative democracy? Is there an element of representative character here in the democratic sublime? I think of the, you know, the beauty and sublimity of the architecture of Washington, D.C., or the institutions of government, the halls of Congress. I was thinking about this in the context of, you know, when we all had to, you know, suffer through this, you know, the January 6th riots in D.C., and one of the real pernicious features there was about, you know, how they sort of the grandeur of the Congress was really being assaulted and put in part in addition to all the other assaults. But so, in other words, I'm wondering about the institutional side of things. Is there room, in your view, for a sort of the sublime of representative democracy, or, you know, is there something distinctive about democratic assembly? Why you focused on that?
Yeah. I've learned a great deal from historians and others, even some political scientists who've studied what we might think of as the ritual operations of democratic and representative institutions, you know, the ceremonial grandeur that goes in to sustaining the authority of parliamentary procedures, right? For example, not to mention the presidential aesthetics and the way in which it draws from and revises a longer history of kind of royalist aesthetics. So that are an important part of executive and presidential power. So I've learned a great deal from the historians and also cultural anthropologists. I mean, I think of Clifford Geertz, for example, who has very canonical work on some of these kinds of questions. So I don't think anything that I'm doing in this book denies the importance of let's just kind of say broadly questions of political aesthetics to institutional representative institutions and including civic architecture, memorials, the organization of the built environment of democracy. I'm open to all of that. I've read a lot of that work and have gotten a lot from it. Actually, one of the early chapters in this book appeared in a collection called The Scaffolding of Sovereignty, which was mostly historians from a widely diverse set of periods who were kind of looking at just this question and mostly focused on kind of architecture, institutions, the trappings, the kind of scaffolding of sovereign power. So I see this project as very much in line with that kind of work, but really, you know, from the perspective of democratic theory. Now, it is true that I'm making an argument about the democratic sublime, as I reconstruct it here, is very much anchored in this newly kind of wildly reconceptualized role that crowds and large gatherings of the people out of doors play in the context of either democratic or democratizing politics. So to give you an example, you know, I'll draw from a couple of historians. William Sewell, who you may know, kind of a historian, but who's also engaged in interesting work of social theory, has an argument about the storming, about what qualifies an event as an event. He's looking at the storming of the Bastille in 1789. And he notes this remarkable transformation that occurs from a riotous crowd seen as simply a source of violence or need or irrationality, all of a sudden transformed and elevated into an instance of the legitimate articulation of the collective will itself, where the crowd becomes a carrier, the materially embodied physical crowd becomes a carrier of the kind of dignity and the grandeur of and the sublimity of sovereign power. So it's true that in this book, I'm very interested in that dynamic. I'm very interested in how the crowd, the popular assembly, I kind of use the language of popular assembly very broadly in the book, becomes the source of this sublime experience in this period and then well into the 19th century. So I don't see this as antithetical to the kinds of concerns that your kind of lines of inquiry that I hear in your question, but I do want to carve out something specific about the aesthetic contour, the experience of mass collectivities in democratic contexts. I kind of want to say from the late 18th century up to the present day. You know, I mean, I focus on the age of revolution, 1776 to 1848, but as you know from reading the book, I'm interested in reconstructing something historical there that is very much meant to have productive resonance with these same phenomena in our own time.
Right. Yeah. And it's you know, I mean, what you're talking about is more distinctive in a certain way than the representative institutions and architecture. I mean, if you just think about the DC buildings, I mean, they're modeled on classical architecture, right? On sort of the, you know, even if Republican, it's pre-popular sovereignty, right? So the continuity with a monarchical tradition and the executive office. So I could see, I mean, that's why it makes this so interesting and its connection with the developments in aesthetics towards a kind of imminent conception makes us distinctive in a certain way and exciting.
I mean, I like Jeff that I wanted there to be something counterintuitive in the concept of the democratic sublime, right? So, you know, even the two parts of that concept, like if you think about what is democratic and what is sublime, they exist in a kind of tension with one another. I mean, if we think of democracy as the idea of collective self-rule in modern context, something very close to ideas of collective autonomy. And you think of the sublime as that which transcends human autonomy, which is about the limitation of human powers of reason, of representation, of instrumentality. There is a kind of, I meant for there to be a kind of tension between the two component parts of this concept. So there's the historical, you know, counterintuitive quality that we've started talking about. But I also mean that there to be a kind of conceptual counterintuitive quality to this idea of the democratic sublime. I just don't see that tension as a contradiction. I'm trying to portray it as, you know, a dynamic tension that involves a relationship between antagonistic parts, the democratic part and the sublime component, and to really try to build a case for the productivity of that dynamism rather than some kind of fatal contradiction in terms. But I'm glad you're picking up on the kind of counterintuitive idea that's already there in the title of the book, because it is the, I meant for it to have something of that, to kind of jar us a bit from the more familiar stories we bring to this period and its central questions for democratic theory.
Yeah, well, as a fan of Kant, I applaud your use of the sublime in this way, because Kant, of course, is, yeah, I mean, one of these figures who tries to, well, immanentize in a certain way the conception of the sublime. That is, the sublime is our reaction to our own freedom, right? It's not about something above human autonomy, but it's our, it's the aesthetic response to our own autonomy. So you can see that. So I don't know if you have anything to say about Kant, feel free. We don't want to get derailed here from. I think Kant may get some mention in your book, but there is, in any case.
I guess I would say, Jeff, that, I mean, you're right. You can't have a book on the sublime in political theory and not say something about Kant. And in the introduction, I do discuss Kant a bit, but, you know, Kant's conception of the sublime, I mean, and you're right, we're not going to dig into the details of, the complexities of the third critique, but the idea that we experience our own limitation, right? Say in the natural sublime, the sense of being overwhelmed by the magnitude and the grandeur and the sublimity of nature. And therefore we feel a limit on our own capacities, a sense of being overwhelmed. But then we come to, through that experience itself, as you said, have an account of our own freedom or an experience of our own freedom that sets us apart from the determinisms and the mechanisms of nature. And so it kind of, Kant always returns us to the capaciousness of our own freedom of will. And I, in this book, I mean, you know, I have a chapter on Burke, not a chapter on Kant. And I don't think there's a lot of differences, obviously, between the kind of philosophical underpinnings of Burke's kind of empirical account of the sublime and Kant's transcendental idealism. But Burke never reconciles the experience of the sublime to human freedom and human capacity. I think for him, it's always a kind of experienced as a kind of heteronomic to limitation to human capacity and human reason. And that establishes the kind of dynamic tension between the terms democracy and the sublime that I'm working with in the book in a way that I don't think Kant does. And in any case, to really engage Kant in any detail on these questions, as you know, it wouldn't just be a chapter of its own. I mean, it would vary, you know, I just was afraid that it would quickly overwhelm the entire project.
A wise choice, I think, there. Good. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's jump into the sort of the frame of the book in terms of the engagement you're making with democratic theory, because this is in moving from your introduction to the first chapter, you mentioned this question, I think, in the your opening remarks about the book, which is that you know one of the challenges, I think, for contemporary democratic theory, among many sort of puzzles that it raises, is the question about how to identify or individuate the people. You know, what is the people? And it's a difficult question because you can't actually ever see the people, right? Any one individual or any group, the people always transcends that individual or that particular group. So there's no way to pick it out through visual cues. So as you point out, contemporary democratic theory is very influenced by Carl Schmitt and Claude Lefort on taking up a rather than an aesthetic, which you the path you take, but more of a political theological alternative to thinking about what is the people. And it's interesting, you know, so you're trying to provide more of an aesthetic way to answer this question, whereas the sort of dominant way is a more theological way. So maybe if you could just briefly sort of, you know, walk us through, you know, what is it this, you know, theological way that they conceive of it? What are its problems, and how do you think about things differently?
Yeah. So what I'm trying to do with the engagement with Schmitt and Lefort, you're exactly right, Jeff, is try to kind of reorient democratic theory away from what I think of as the traps of a political theological way of engaging with these questions. So in that chapter, I try to elaborate what I call the people as a problem of popular manifestation. And the way that I conceive this is related to a very familiar problem in democratic theory that you've already just kind of invoked, which we often talk about in terms of the boundary problem, right? And that is just to say, you know, who makes up the people that is the source of democratic authority is not a question that can itself be democratically decided, right? Because it's precisely the entity that would go about making that decision that is put in question, or the question is subverted by the premises of its resolution. There's a kind of paradox there. You know, the boundary problem operates on this kind of paradox, but it is the kind of who are the people at the source of democratic authority. Now, the problem of manifestation is more explicitly, as you said, an aesthetic problem. And it is the question of how the sovereign subject of democratic politics publicly appears, right? How it makes itself tangible to the senses, how the people take shape as a collective actor when the formal rules and procedures for identifying popular will, elections say, like that are fully legally authorized, do not exist or are so deeply contested that they don't have that kind of that they're deauthorized. So that way of framing the problem of the people as popular manifestation does bring the theory that I'm trying to develop in this book into contact with contemporary debates about constituent power, the people as the ultimate source of constitution-making authority. Now, Schmitt and Lefort, I kind of provocatively put Schmitt and Lefort together on this question because obviously they're very far apart politically. But I do think that the comparing them on this question can show to reveal how both Schmitt and Lefort are kind of attuned and engaged with aspects of what I'm calling this kind of aesthetic problem of popular manifestation, how the people appears. But in their work, I try to demonstrate in that chapter, this gets kind of detoured or derailed into a political, theological problematic. Very clearly in Schmitt, who is obviously, you know, the 20th century's most influential theorist of political theology, not only in his theory of sovereignty, of course, his book, Political Theology, is where you find his theory of sovereignty. Sovereign is he who decides on the exception, but especially in his theory of representation in Roman Catholicism and political form. So Lefort seems to be the opposite, right? For Lefort, you have democracy being associated famously with the empty space of power. Democracy is about the disincorporation of power for Lefort, but there's always a temptation to re-embody power within democracy, to kind of reinstill reincarnate. I mean, the language is really that of incarnation. I think both Schmitt and Lefort are deeply wedded, though at opposite polarities of evaluation, to a kind of a political theology of incarnation when they think about democratic authority. And what I'm trying to do in emphasizing the aesthetic is to have us appreciate these different modes of popular appearance instead of going immediately down the road of asking the foundational political theological question of who in the last instance is the sovereign, like where is the locus of sovereign authority incontrovertibly located. Now, I don't want to go into like, you know, too much detail with my readings of Schmidt and Lefort. I don't think that's the purpose of these kinds of things. But I will just conclude by saying this, Jeff. Instead of the political theological problem of incarnation, the focus on popular manifestation that I outline wants to get democratic theorists to dwell, to stay on the surface, as you will, of these different modes of collective and popular appearance, to develop a kind of an aesthetic vocabulary and orientation for understanding divergences and continuities across these different modalities of appearance, rather than going right beyond that question of appearance to you know, the kind of what I see as the kind of foundational and metaphysical questions of political theology. And this is a reason that in this book, you know, so that kind of reorientation that I'm talking about away from political theology and towards kind of an aesthetic approach to these questions, that is a part of the reason for the somewhat eclectic and interdisciplinary archive of the book. I mean, I'm not primarily engaged in this book with constitutional debates, constitutional deliberations, or even, you know, the formal deliberations that take place in courts or parliamentary proceedings. Instead, I'm looking at manifestos, at visual culture, at popular literature, at memoirs, as well as canonical works of political theory that I do think are more engaged and attentive to these aesthetic questions than is most contemporary democratic theory.
Yeah, good. I mean, one of the questions I had about this was, I mean, part of what I don't know Lefort that well, but Schmidt, you know, part of the motivation for, you know, trying to get to the bottom of who, you know, what the sovereign is, it's a juridical or a normative question, right? I mean, to sort of distinguish the appearance of a sovereign from the real sovereign. And so I guess one question I had for you was in the sense of the sort of the status of the you know, normative question in democratic theory with this sort of aesthetic approach that you take. Is there a way to distinguish between legitimate and illegitimate appearances of the democratic sublime? Like, I'm thinking back to January 6th and the riot there at the Capitol. I mean, I don't know, QAnon followers may have said that was sublime. I'm not sure, but, you know, presumably you wouldn't. So is there a way, you know, I mean, does that normative question sort of, I mean, I could see a kind of Schmidtian coming back and saying something like that about your project. So I just wondered if you had a thought about that.
Yeah, no, this is a good question. I mean, I do think this question follows up very directly on what we were just talking about. And it also speaks maybe to a larger question of what we're doing when we do democratic theory or what we should expect of democratic theory. Especially in its relation to democratic politics. So in this book, I focus primarily on moments when the appeal to the juridical people, or let's say the way that popular voice is legally authorized in the organized institutions of the state, the way that people get converted into an electorate, right? I focused on moments when that appeal to the juridical people is insufficient to adjudicate between competing claims of peoplehood, right? So there is a familiar theoretical space that's opened up, certainly in radical democratic theory or kind of agonistic democratic theory, which leads directly to, I think, the point, the sharp point of your question, which is how do you distinguish in that context then the legitimate from an illegitimate revolutionary people? And I think that a certain kind of normative democratic theory, still probably the dominant approach, but maybe not quite as hegemonic as it used to be, demands that democratic theory provide principles or norms, procedures, criteria, right, for being able to distinguish clearly the one from the other, right, the legitimate from the illegitimate. And in this way, that kind of democratic theory, I think, mirrors the very juridical orientation that animates its fundamental questions. I don't see myself as doing normative democratic theory in this way. It's not that it's not normative or that it's merely factual. You know, I don't mean to be, deploying a kind of naive fact value distinction here, but I'm interested in exploring fundamental dilemmas, right, or problems that have accompanied the emergence of popular sovereignty. Dilemmas or problems that I do not think can be resolved by the normative drive to provide such criteria, but instead, they're usually the problematics that I'm interested in exploring in this book are evaded by that drive, they're obfuscated, or more commonly, they're just ignored as problems that democratic theorists should be centrally preoccupied with. So the question of legitimacy or the illegitimacy of fundamental enactments or claims of peoplehood are often difficult to resolve in the moment of enactment itself, right? I mean, it's easier retrospectively to kind of project, we can identify the legitimate from the illegitimate with a backward glance to see what came out of those movements. But, you know, I think there is a kind of a great degree of contingency and kind of disorientation at the moment of these enactments itself. Now, that does not mean, to get to your Schmitt point, that we are faced then with some kind of normative abyss, you know, that it's or the fundamental undecidability between the legitimacy or the illegitimacy of these moments, or that it's a fundamentally groundless moment of decision, right? Not at all. I think that's also very metaphysical. You know, it's kind of the foundational or is it anti-foundational? There are all kinds of normative languages that we can draw on to make a case one way or another for the legitimacy or the illegitimacy of one popular enactment versus another, and thinking about what kind of claims to delegitimize the insurrection of January 6th that are available to us. We have, you know, a wide and rich normative world of discourse to argue for the illegitimacy of that action. That does not necessarily have to replace or kind of substitute for the emphasis that I've given in the story that I tell in this book on the phenomena of popular manifestation itself, kind of like not wanting to kind of keeping it open to getting to orienting and attuning democratic theorists to these different forms of popular enactment and popular assembly without having to fall back in the last instance on a set of normative criteria that would allow us to endorse one and delegitimize the other. So I don't think it's an either, you know, I guess it really is about what, you know, I think reconstructing how these dilemmas are navigated historically in different times and places with different works and different archives, rather than resolved kind of theoretically, that can itself be a very productive path, I guess, for historically situated democratic theory, and can be illuminating of our own contemporary confrontations with similar dilemmas. It's not the same dilemma all the time. It can orient us and attune us to important questions, even if it doesn't satisfy the normative demands that I think is kind of behind, you know, that poses that question of fundamental legitimacy or illegitimacy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what I find so helpful about your analysis is the sort of is the deep conception of the sublime that you develop, because it's not just, you can't just say, well, if a group thinks that, you know, if QAnon followers experience some sense of the sublime, then it's the sublime, right? I mean, it has to actually, as you bring out, there's a complexity to this experience within democracy that allows us to sort of be able to analyze these moments of collectivity more closely. You don't just have to defer to what people themselves say they experience. So let's dig into some of your analysis here, because as you say, you talk about Rousseau, Burke, and Tocqueville, the main thinkers, but you also have a couple chapters which are quite interesting that sort of delve in deep into some of the iconography and the art, indeed, that sort of make this point. Just to start with where you do with Rousseau, you know, the centerpiece of your analysis in Rousseau is about Rousseau's view of popular assembly, especially as it's presented in book three of the Social Contract. Maybe you could talk a little bit, I think you mentioned this a couple minutes ago, about Rousseau isn't a theorist of the sublime, but you see the sublime as manifested in the people's own sort of self-consciousness in the activity of popular assembly. You sort of bring that out for us and what the tensions are there that you see.
Yeah. So I start with a kind of familiar problem in the Rousseau scholarship, especially the democratic theory Rousseau scholarship, you know, kind of focused appropriately on the theory of popular sovereignty, the theory of legitimacy articulated in the Social Contract. And the problem is, when Rousseau actually goes about describing, and this is kind of before book three, this is in the early, already in the first book, when he describes how the sovereign assembly operates, what happens in the sovereign assembly, you get a kind of surprising account, because he doesn't present the sovereign assembly, it's expressly not a space of deliberation, right? This is not, this is not the ratio-critical public sphere writ small in an assembly. And neither is it a place where orators are addressing the assembled crowds. It is a very strangely silent assembly. And that's why the chapter on Rousseau is called Rousseau's Silent Assemblies. The gathered citizens look into their own heart to deliberate on the question of the general will, but they do not deliberate amongst one another to identify that will. So there's a kind of a looking inward, right? A looking into one's heart, but crucially in the collective co-presence of others, right? So the actual assembly is very important. The physical gathering is very important for Rousseau's theory. So in order to elaborate what is going on there, I make an argument that attending to Rousseau's account of the aesthetics of collective absorption in other aspects, in other areas of his work, I mean, the letter to D'Alembert, obviously, on the theater, on spectacle, but also in the Emile, and I draw some from the first and second, you know, from a variety of different sources. But I try to make a convincing argument that in order to understand the kind of conceptual moves that Rousseau is making in the Social Contract and the centrality of the sovereign popular assembly there, you really have to engage with the more expressly aesthetic dimensions of his other work, where the kind of question of absorption, and especially collective absorption, rather than an aesthetics of theatricality, I'm taking that distinction from the art historian Michael Fried, who talks about this in really brilliant detail, looking at especially Diderot, but kind of this broader shift in kind of 18th century French aesthetics. But I make the argument that the account, therefore, of like the festivals and the writings on Corsica and Poland, the that he describes and that he kind of envisions in those texts, all participate in this aesthetics of collective self-regard and absorption, kind of the people regarding themselves in their own dignity and grandeur without the mediations of theatrical devices and so on. So the attempt is not to show how Rousseau's theory of the relationship between aesthetics and popular assembly is the one that we should claim and endorse, but it's to say that the paradigmatic theorist of modern popular sovereignty was deeply attuned to these very questions of the aesthetic dimensions of popular assembly that I explore more broadly in the book, but that have been largely neglected by democratic theory. So it's to kind of try to reconstruct how these different pieces work together in Rousseau's very canonical work as a way of kind of orienting contemporary political theorists and democratic theorists to what I see as the neglected centrality of these questions.
Yeah, that's great. It reminds me of, there's an article John Scott published a number of years ago on Rousseau about, you know, like the theological elements in, you know, Rousseau's general will. I mean, Rousseau will constantly talk about how, you know, of course there's the, you know, the voice of the people is the voice of God.
Sure.
There's a constant invocation of the sort of divinity of the expression of the general will through the people. I didn't know if that, you know, I mean, is that, I mean, that of course is the theological element. Right. So is the, I'm not sure how that kind of thing square. I mean, I'll say this. I mean, the way that Rousseau immanentizes, and if you look at the sort of history of the general will, there's been some scholarship on this, how the general will was once a term to refer to God's will, you know, Rousseau sort of immanentizes it. Anyway, it sort of fits exactly in with the account that you're developing of the sort of immanentizing of the general. I didn't know if you had any thoughts about, theological elements here too.
I will say this. I am familiar. I don't know the particular piece by Joan Scott that you mentioned, but I just wrote it down in my notebook and I will be looking it up because I always find her work really interesting. But I am familiar with the larger kind of approach to Rousseau, you know, that we can characterize as kind of that takes kind of questions of political theology as central to what he is kind of working with and trying to innovate on in the social contract. I mean, oftentimes these are focused on the idea of civil religion that comes at the very end of the book. But you're right, it's not only that, it's already there in the concept of general will. And there's debates among Rousseau scholars about how theologically indebted that conception of the general will is to these earlier kind of more clearly theistic debates. So it's true that that's not, I am engaged by those kinds of readings of Rousseau, and I can see how they kind of can overlap and parallel with some of the central questions that I'm interested in asking, unlike what I take to be a very influential kind of contemporary way of engaging Rousseau, which is to familiarize him with the central concerns and preoccupations of contemporary liberal democratic theory. So that could either be the kind of deontological, like, you know, the reading of Rousseau and Rousseau's relationship to Kant that you get in Rawls, which is very influential, which I think takes the things that I am most interested in, you know, the aesthetic component, the figure of the lawgiver, the emphasis on ritual and game playing and subject and kind of political subjectivity, sees them as kind of unnecessary anachronisms, really, that kind of detract from the way in which his theory of moral autonomy anticipates and then is fully developed and articulated in the Kantian tradition. So that's one route of familiarization. And then another route, which is one that I feel more affinity with, is like that influentially taken up by Richard Tuck in his book, The Sleeping Sovereign, where Rousseau becomes a very important contemporary figure for thinking about constitutional authorization in recognizably liberal terms, right? So it's kind of like the central concerns and preoccupations of contemporary liberal democratic theory. We look back at Rousseau and the way in which he anticipates and can contribute to those debates. You know, I think some of the most interesting and telling aspects of Rousseau's political theory are those that get sidelined or bracketed as idiosyncratic or as anachronistic from within the viewpoints of these contemporary preoccupations. So when I start that chapter with the quote from the last paragraph, really, I think, of the essay on the origin of languages, where Rousseau says, "The subjects must be kept apart. That is the first maxim of modern politics." It's like, well, let's stop there. The first maxim of modern politics is keeping subjects physically apart. Like, that seems to me a road in to a very different set of questions that Rousseau is trying to provide answers to than are asked by the central preoccupations of a good deal of contemporary democratic theory.
Right. And the lawgiver, I wanted to ask you about the lawgiver too, because the lawgiver seems to be another figure who just sort of resists the sort of liberal, I don't know, taming of Rousseau.
Yes.
Right. The lawgiver is another one of these, it's a like godlike figure. You know, how do you think about the lawgiver within the context of the sublime? Is the lawgiver, him or herself, a sort of sublime figure? Does the lawgiver sort of invest the people with sublimity? You know, how do you think about the lawgiver in the context of Rousseau and sublime?
If any of my graduate students are going to listen to this podcast, Jeff, I think now this is the moment where they're like, oh my God, he's completely teed up Jason Frank on the question of the lawgiver. So I see the lawgiver the lawgiver problem as it gets articulated in the social contract as very relevant to the questions that I'm asking in this book. So what I take the basic contours of that problem to be, the way in which the lawgiver is introduced in book 2, chapter 7 of the social contract, is to resolve a paradox, which is to say, in order for a people to become capable of ongoing practices of political freedom and self-governance, they first have to be given form and shaped as a people with those capacities. But, and so you can't simply, those capacities don't exist kind of in the world. They have to be brought about. So there's a kind of a chicken and egg problem here. Well, who would have, if the people are the ultimate source of authority, who would have the authority to give them shape and give, right, to acquire the abilities, the virtues for these ongoing practices of self-governance? Now, that is an old problem. I mean, that is a problem that is, it's central to the book of Exodus, for example. It's an old problem of the lawgiver and political education, but it takes on a different normative resonance in Rousseau because it's articulated within the broader context of a theory of popular sovereignty as the sole source of legitimate political authority. So the lawgiver is a figure of democratic autonomy's inevitable reliance or elicitation of some kind of heteronomic support, right? That is what I think that is a basic problem of democratic theory that is formally modeled by the figure of the lawgiver in Rousseau. So far from an unfortunate anachronism, I actually think that Rousseau, and it's not just me, I mean, you know, Bonnie Honig's written about this, Alan Keenan's written about this, Bill Connolly has written, you know, this is a kind of an approach in contemporary democratic theory, radical democratic theory, that recognizes the importance of that chapter to understanding this problem. It's not an anachronism. It actually more clearly sees dilemmas of popular self-authorization that are kind of bracketed, let's just say, by Kant and certainly like the tradition in democratic theory that follows from Kant. So how that relates to aesthetics and to the sublime is then you start looking at, well, how does the lawgiver enact this formative power, right? I don't think it's just a placeholder for you know, he invokes a sublime reasoning, Rousseau says. He persuades without convincing, because you don't agree, you know, we don't yet have the conceptual vocabulary to be rationally convinced. So there is some kind of rhetorical persuasion, disciplinary shaping that's going on. And Rousseau at those moments explicitly invokes a rhetorical or a kind of an aesthetic register for that work of political education. And as you know from reading the book, that lawgiver chapter for me is really the hinge that allows me to connect the question of the proceedings of the sovereign popular assembly in the social contract with the much more explicitly aesthetic renderings of festivals and other forms of collective self-regard that become so important in other areas of Rousseau's work.
Yeah, it's great. Your reading is great in part because it makes so clear to me why it's a democratic sublime rather than a democratic beautiful, right? Because right. The sublime requires this element of, I mean, there's a kind of element of discipline and awe and that's distinguished from, you know, a very different kind of experience from the beautiful. The lawgiver can invoke the beautiful in order to beautiful forms of persuasion in order to bring the people together into a whole. It has to be a form of sublime to denature them, as Rousseau says. So yeah, that's great. So to shift gears to I wanted to talk about since check the time here. We've been talking for an hour here and only gotten through a couple chapters. So this is what happened. So I wanted to take up next your discussion, rather than of the sort of the political theorists, the canonical political theorists, to talk about your couple chapters on sort of iconography and art of the 19th century. You know, two chapters in particular, chapter 3 and chapter 5. The chapter 3 charts the development or the immanentizing, I guess, of the sublime from to sort of ancien, it's associated with the ancien regime to popular sovereignty. And then chapter 5 is quite an interesting chapter on the sort of aesthetics of barricades as they're used in the revolutionary period. So just to start with the chapter 3 on the, as you say, the living image of the people, could just give us a couple examples of, you know, this transition in popular culture of the time, the 19th century, especially talk a fair bit about the French Revolution, the French Revolutionary period, you know, what that transition looked like, how in some examples did we turn from, you know, the monarch being conceived of in sublime terms to the people?
Yeah, that chapter, I mean, in some ways, the book as a whole really, this is one of the first chapters I wrote. So I'll start by saying something about the living image of the people, and then we can talk about the barricade chapter. But the book as a whole kind of, it almost emerged as you know, if you think of this chapter as the central, you know, the in some ways the core of the book's concerns, that all of the other chapters kind of like, as I started pursuing these questions more deeply and in more detail, the other chapters kind of emerged out of the core theoretical questions I was engaging in the living image of the people. So the chapter attempts, as you said, Jeff, to trace how, you know, this epochal shift from royal to popular sovereignty over the course of, you know, this time period of the age of democratic revolutions did not only entail fundamental transitions in political norms or in the organization of political institutions and laws, but also in the popular visualization and form of sovereign power. So you're right, it is kind of about the iconography, the visual culture of rule and sovereign authority. So it starts out with, as you said, the iconology of royal power, the king's two bodies, power emanating from the body of the king, and how the kind of normative and political contention around that as the basis of rule, beginning in the, I start by looking at the English Civil War in the middle of the 17th century before going to France also in the 17th century, and then obviously with the 18th. But how those direct confrontations with legitimating norms of royal authority were entangled with different efforts to envision or literally visualize this new sovereign authority of the people, how that kind of worked itself out on canvases, in woodblocks, you know, in visual culture more broadly. Now, this is obviously a fairly stylized picture. I mean, I'm moving across three centuries and trying to tell a story of the kind of dilemmas and the debates that the kind of aesthetic debates that accompanied these more familiar, at least for democratic theorists, debates around political legitimacy. And that basic story that I tell starts with the body of the king in portraiture, say, moves to the kind of relocation of that sovereign authority into the body of the people, also depicted visually or depicted in sculptures. I talk about the Hercules that became so important for picturing the French people at the most radical during the Jacobin period of the French Revolution. But then ultimately kind of leaves the world of art as canvas or sculpture, and via the festival, right, these kind of living enactments of where the people become actors in their own artistic performances. Rousseau is obviously a very pivotal figure for this theory, although I don't talk about him in this chapter, but we've already dealt with him in the first, you know, he kind of haunts this chapter, I think. To ultimately, you know, the source of sublime experience being these gatherings of collectives that are not only these state orchestrated festivals, the festival of the supreme being, you know, the French Revolution's kind of, especially again at its most radical stage, obsession with staging these popular festivals. So I'm kind of interested in how, you know, the iconography of power leaves the inanimate realm, you might say, of the oil painting or the sculpture, and comes to be embodied in the performance of the people themselves. Now, I think if I were to rewrite that chapter now, I would draw out precisely the point that I'm making to you more than I do. I think it's kind of it's there, and I, you know, but I think it's a very key part of what that chapter is trying to do, to show how the body of the people themselves become a source of sublime experience as they become the source of sovereign power.
Yeah, that's good. I, and apologies for zooming in on the oil painting side of things, in part because I'm interested in the painter Jacques-Louis David, who you mentioned in the I had a master's student who wrote a master's thesis on David, which is and politics, which is good thesis. But I wonder what you think about him in the context of your thesis, in part because he's a sort of neoclassical painter, so there are elements of the beautiful in his painting. In part, like the portrait of Napoleon has this sort of classical character. But I'm also thinking of like the death of Marat, which is there are elements of the sublime in there, but there's also he's fighting and dying, but he's dying for the people too. He's in a bathtub. So maybe not the most sublime moment. In any case, I don't know if do you see him as part of this story of the development of the sublime in the form of the people, or is he, sort of a contrary figure?
Oh no, I think he's a very pivotal figure. No, I think you're right that David is key, and partly in his paintings. I mean, David is the painter of probably the single most famous piece depicting the enactment of constituent power with his tennis court, the tennis court oath. I guess it was a painting that was never fully realized, but we have the preparatory work for that painting, and it's deservedly very, very famous. But also in the larger kind of cultural advocacy of the importance of aesthetics and aesthetic production in assisting and guiding this transition away from royal authority to the sovereignty of the people. So during the revolution's most radical phase, as I said, under Jacobin rule, I mean, it was David that led the efforts to enthrone the Hercules wielding his club as the central figure of sovereign people. He was very much involved in these debates. The Hercules had been a figure of sovereign royal power in France, going back to to Louis XIV as a figure of popular sovereignty. I mean, you think about like what is entailed by Hercules wielding his club. I mean, it's hardly a deliberative figure, right? It's there's no deliberation or discussion. It's about undeniable will, force, inevitability, strength, courage, all of these virtues. David did not only advocate on behalf of the Hercules, but as you know from reading that chapter, if you didn't know before, he actually proposed to the convention that an enormous sculpture of Hercules be erected on the square at Pont-Neuf atop a huge mound of rubble that would be taken from the destroyed royal effigies on the porticos of Notre Dame, that the people would rise on the destroyed effigies of royal power. This was not exactly a period of subtle political political allegory. So David, I think he's very, very, very central and plays an important role. I mean, you raise the example of David's famous painting of the death of Marat, and I will just say this about that painting. I do take that painting to be a part of the broader dynamic of these kind of dilemmas of popular visualization that I talk about in that chapter and in the book more broadly. But obviously it's not in the mode of a sublime popular assembly. I mean, it's Marat, as you say, in his bathtub with his pen and his letter. So the broader problems of popular manifestation, of how to make the people visible, how to make them appear publicly, available to public judgment. I have focused on the question of popular assembly, but popular assembly is one part of a broader kind of dilemma around this question of popular manifestation. And another element of it is an adjacent discourse and visual repertoire surrounding the sublime revolutionary hero, right? And Miguel Abensur, who's, you know, very interesting French political theorist, student of Lefort, has written about this question, the figure of the revolutionary hero, a Marat, a Sade, a Saint-Just. That hero also embodies the revolutionary will of the people, guides them forward in the absence of legal forms or settled institutional procedures, a figure of pure action is what Abensur, how he describes it. And I think that I think David's painting, I think The Death of Marat is much more about that. I think it's much more about this kind of question of the sacrifice of the revolutionary hero than what I focused on in this book, the kind of problem of popular assembly. But I see them as I said, kind of adjacent discourses and kind of overlapping visual repertoires.
Yeah, I mean, they could be complementary in that sense.
I think that's true.
The sense that it's, you know, the sublimity of the democratic assembly is one of self-regard, right? And the contemplation of one's own sublimity, whereas The Death of Marat is a sort of a contemplation of this hero's sublimity, right? Which can serve as a kind of ennoblement,
yeah,
right, for the revolutionary cause. So they can both be a way of ennobling, but also as empowering, yeah, at the same time. So I can see that.
That's, I mean, I think heroism is the is also the connecting thread here, right? I mean, it is very much, whether in its collective manifestation or in the figure of the revolutionary hero, this idea of a kind of a heroic agency that is, for the collective, the power and ability to democratically and collectively set the course for the politics that are equally experienced, like to set the course for a common fate. And the revolutionary hero, who also has this very amplified conception of agency, but no longer thought in kind of simply military or martial terms, but it's also kind of working with and in conjunction, sometimes stepping in place of the people. I mean, Robespierre says, you know, I am not a delegate of the people or a representative, I am the people myself. You know, that's an interesting transfiguration of l'état, c'est moi. You know, it's this kind of revolutionary transfiguration of it. But I agree with you. I think that these are there's an interesting relationship between these discourses and visual repertoires that I don't really explore in any detail in the book. But I think it could be done, and it probably has been done by art historians.
Great. So the chapter on barricades, fast forwards us a little bit into the 19th century, but the widespread use of barricades for revolutionary peoples, gets treatment in this chapter in terms of the democratic sublime. So I'm interested. Maybe you could just sort of give us some examples of the way in which barricades were visualized, or in the case of you have a lengthy discussion of Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, and maybe you could say a little bit about that novel and how, sure, the sort of tensions again can reemerge here in the image of the barricades.
Sure. I mean, this is the last chapter that I completed, during the first months of the pandemic, but it is the one, maybe because of that, it's the one that I still feel closest to and the one that I wish I could kind of work on more. It still seems to be very much alive to me. But so barricades themselves as barricade events, and the kind of tactic of the barricade goes all the way back to the 16th century. It's not a creation of this era of democratic revolution. So even though they go back that far, barricades only really become a part of, let's say, revolutionary consciousness or a central figure of collective action after the revolution of 1830, which installs the July monarchy. And that's when, you know, barricades appear. I don't have the exact numbers with it, but I mean, like, the number of barricades that spring up around Paris is just remarkable in 1830. So there were precedents, or even some examples of barricade action in the revolution of 1789. I've learned a lot about all of the details of this history from Marc Trugot, who's a historian and a sociologist of social movements, who has a great book on barricade acts. But one of the things that I try to draw out in this chapter, which is called The Poetics of the Barricade, is to see how the emergence of barricades as a central figure of revolutionary consciousness can be understood as responding to the dilemmas of popular manifestation that I associate with the democratic sublime, right? So the barricade, the poetics of the barricade, so it's visual culture, as you said, it's in poetry. I look at Baudelaire, it's in romantic literature, and Hugo is the preeminent manifestation of the kind of sublime depiction of the barricade in Les Miserables. And I will say something brief about that in a second. But I try to read all of, you know, this kind of proliferating cultural figurations of barricade events as one way in which this kind of dilemma of popular manifestation gets worked out across different registers of popular culture. One of the things that's very interesting to me about all of these depictions is how many commentators, and whether it be kind of historians in the 19th century, writing about the revolutions of the 19th century, emphasize barricades, or travelers who happen to be in Paris and talk about the experience of witnessing the barricades going up. For political theorists, I would just say, you know, remind yourselves of what Tocqueville says about barricade acts in his recollections on the revolution of 1848. They continually return to this question of the spontaneous erection of the barricades, that with the construction of the barricades, there is no general, there are no blueprints that are being, right, kind of implemented at various, across various streets and alleyways in the worker districts of Paris, but they constantly emphasize that the people themselves seem to emerge and know exactly what they're doing in the intricate construction of these barricades around the city. So that idea of a kind of an agency that emerges spontaneously on the part of the people themselves, rather than being directed or guided, or, you know, I think is a very important part of the mythos, or the kind of magic of barricade consciousness that I'm interested in exploring in this chapter on the poetics of the barricades. So I'll say something about Hugo. I mean,
right. And just to say, barricades are not super orderly.
No.
Right. They kind of have that martial courage, heroism, right?
Exactly.
So I can see how there's a sublimity there.
They're sites of sacrifice.
Right.
You know, and they're also clearly sites of demarcation, you know, and they do operate to produce insurgent identity, collective identity. So if we're kind of talking about dynamics of peopling, and one of the things that the barricade does, and I go into this in some detail in that chapter, I mean, it's clearly a line of antagonism, right? And we know from many contemporary democratic theorists, I mean, I'll just mention Ernesto Laclau, since this is such a central part of his theory of popular identification. Those literal lines of antagonism and conflict are not only expressions of already existing political identities. They themselves become sites for the production of those political identities. And barricades clearly operate in that work, even though in that way, even though they are also much more permeable sites than they're often get. I mean, this is where insurgents actually speak with military figures, where there's the attempt to bring members of the populace that are not already on the side of the insurgents into the insurgent camp. So there's a lot of there's a lot going on at that productive site of the barricade. Trugeau calls them nodes of insurrectionary activity to capture the buzzing. You know, so much is happening. It's not just conflict, you know, but it is that too. It is also sites of conflict and of sacrifice. So, you know, for me, the greatest and the most theoretically rich and compelling treatment of the poetics of the barricade as an example of the democratic sublime comes in Hugo's Les Misérables in book 10. And what's interesting about book 10, you know, the novel is itself set in 1832 in the context of a failed Republican uprising after the successful revolution of 1830. The July monarchy is established, and then there's a Republican rebellion in 1832 that has failed. But that is really, that's where the kind of drama of the novel, that's where it centers. But Hugo has all of these famous digressions, some of which go on for, you know, many, many pages. And one of those digressions leads Hugo as the narrator and the reader to the construction and the aesthetic experience of the barricades in June of 1848, during the June days, the worker revolt after the February Revolution that is ultimately destroyed, crushed by Cavaignac's troops. You know, thousands of workers are slaughtered in the streets of Paris. And Hugo spends a number of pages, and it really is, it's some of the most powerful writing, not just in that novel, but really it's this incredible, very clearly sublime account of the construction of the enormous barricade at Saint-Antoine. And I try to, you know, engage that description in some detail. I don't want to go into the nuance of my reading. Again, it seems kind of a weird place to go to, like, you know, a detailed description of an interpretation. But basically what I want to do in that section of the chapter is to show that Hugo is very intent on explaining the June insurrection and the motivations of those workers in June of 1848 as what he calls an instance of the mob rising up against the demos. So this is a very clear question, Jeff, actually, to your point about the legitimate form of popular authorization versus the illegitimate. So I try to show the way in which Hugo, who himself was directly involved in the crushing of the worker rebellion of June as a representative in the National Assembly, he voted for the state of siege that authorized Cavaignac to you know, go to war against the workers. But I try to show that the way that he tries to kind of frame his description of these barricades and these clearly moralized contrasting poles of mob versus people, the riot versus the demos, the riot versus the legitimate insurrection. I mean, it really is the question of legitimacy and illegitimacy. So I try to show how the tidy conceptual contrasts that Hugo brings to his understanding of this event are ultimately undone, undermined through the sheer overwhelming aesthetic, you know, the kind of the multiplicity of his prose The elaborate descriptions, his account of the contrasts of the barricades. I mean, you know, you've read these passages, like the kind of diametrically opposed evaluations of what you're experiencing when you see the erection of these massive monuments of popular authority. So it's like the neat conceptual contrasts are undone by his own attempt to capture in literary prose the overwhelming sublime quality of the barricade itself. So it's partly because of that I take book two of Les Misérables to be the supreme literary example of what I'm calling in this book the democratic sublime.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, we're up here at an hour and a half, so I've got to call the conversation to a close, even though I'm tempted to just launch into Edmund Burke and Alexis de Tocqueville now, which I think would really be foolhardy. But, you know, I mean, if we were in a different world and we weren't both chairs of our departments, maybe we could have 3.5 hour conversations. But I do encourage people who are listening to this, you know, to take a look at the book, read, you know, the Burke chapter and the Tocqueville chapter are fascinating. You engage with Jacques Rancière and the conclusion in a great way. So, but let me just thank you so much for how generous you are with your time, Jason. And it's been a great conversation. So thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff. I've really enjoyed the discussion. I really thank you for the opportunity to talk about the book. Had a great time.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.